Ben alluded earlier, obviously, it has been quite a time to move. I'm sure most of you will have paid good attention to the election that happened this week. One thing the children have been pointing out to me as we drive around the sort of lanes and roads around here is how politically engaged everyone is. They do a good count of the different political boards that come up, and keep telling me who seems to be in the ascendancy around here. No prizes for guessing. Elections, though they're a good time, aren't they? Because they sort of remind us of democracy and the sort of freedoms that we enjoy. But they can also be bad as well. And I think there's definitely been a sense this election that there have been a lot of troubling elements about it. As people come together and try and work together, supposedly for the country's good, it's surprising how much animosity and sort of discord can be felt. We've seen the sort of really the sort of depths of what people can go to in terms of a personal attacks on each other, and not just personal attacks though. Of course, some of the very policies and things, wherever we stand on them, you can see that even as people try and work together in the world, yet people are set against each other, and discord and disagreement seems so easy to come by. Ben also mentioned this morning particularly that it's a strange thing that the election should come in a week when we've been remembering the victory in Europe back at the end of the Second World War, when some of the same sort of feelings of interpersonal conflict, a people conflict, conflict between people, reached their sort of ultimate and logical conclusion on the battlefields of Europe. As they had done, just before in the First World War. And so the election, while good, definitely focuses our attention on the difficulties and problems that there are right in the centre of ourselves, in the centre of every person. Well, as we look at this passage in Isaiah tonight, I want you to think about a picture of a country not that dissimilar to ours. A country with a proud heritage. A country that used to be economically strong, the envy of the whole world. A country that had been a political and intellectual powerhouse. One that had good relations with all of its neighboring countries. And a country which, more than that, had been a kind of moral and spiritual leader in its area. The kind of country where people would send their children to go to school. But then this country has been brought to its knees. The northern part of the country has rejected their shared heritage. Political problems have raised huge question marks over who exactly is running the country and will do in the near future. The economy is in tatters. A foreign war threatens in Syria. There are severe threats to national security from religious fanatics from other countries. And any moral or spiritual authority that the nation has ever had has drained away in the face of their political and economic collapse. And worst of all, as this country faces these difficulties, the worst thing of all is the leadership over them. The political leaders that are supposed to be helping out are weak and indecisive, seemingly incapable of wisely fulfilling the duties that have been given to them. Of course, the country that I've described has not been our country, but the nation of Judah at the time that the book of Isaiah was written. A country which had enjoyed a great past, an amazing past at the time of King David and King Solomon, when all of the tribes of Israel had been united together. A time when the whole nation had been a player on the international scene. A nation which now, from Judah's point of view anyway, has been reduced to pretty much just Jerusalem and the surrounding area. And as we look at what God has to say to this nation through the mouth of the prophet Isaiah this evening, we're told an incredible thing about what God has in store for them. And of course, an incredible thing, not just in store for them, but for the whole world. But God promises a new type of leadership, one that's going to allow not only the nation of Judah, but the whole world to escape this kind of cycle of depression, cycle of destruction, and cycle of animosity. A new leader who will bring an end to uncertain government, not just for them, but for us too. Well, if you want to know how Judah ended up in the mess that they're in at this point in Isaiah, you could read 1 2 Kings or 1 2 Chronicles. And the book of Isaiah itself tells us of the problems that they faced. If you were to flick back a few pages to Isaiah chapter 1, you'll see that Judah's in a pretty difficult situation. Chapter 1, verse 8. The daughter of Zion, that is to say Jerusalem, is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a hut in a field of melons, like a city under siege. They're facing destruction. They're facing surrounding on all sides by their enemies, pictured as if they're like the heads. They're like melons. There's so many sort of heads of people coming to attack them. And then if you were to move on to Isaiah chapter 7, the beginning of Isaiah chapter 7, you get a little bit more detail about the specific difficulty that they're facing. Read the first couple of verses. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1, when Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. And if we were to read on, we'd see that God gave Isaiah some words of encouragement. I believe Phil spoke on them not too long ago. But unfortunately, King Ahaz didn't take them up. Judah are facing a terrible situation. The northern tribes have allied with a sort of traditional enemy, the Syrians, and sort of formed an alliance between themselves to come and attack the kingdom of Judah. And the big question is, what are the people in Judah going to do? Are they going to, for example, throw themselves on the God who's protected them this far in their existence and say, God, you know, come and look after us, look after your people, come and protect your temple? Well, that would have been ideal, wouldn't it? But Isaiah tells us what they decided to do. Instead of appealing to the King of Heaven to come and protect them, Ahaz of Judah appealed to the King of Assyria to come and rescue him. Now, we heard a bit about Assyria this morning. Assyria really was sort of the superpower of their day. And, you know, Judah appealing to Assyria to come and help them would be a bit like, you know, if Britain was facing, let's say, an invasion by France and Germany, us appealing to Russia, yeah, to come and protect us from France and Germany. Sort of, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire sort of situation. It's, you know, a kind of catastrophic decision. You know, calling a large Russian army to enter the, you know, the borders of Britain would be a really, really bad idea. And so too, as the Bible paints it, is appealing to Assyria, at that time one of the most bloodthirsty empires of the whole of history. And in fact, as if you were to read on in the story, you would see that it did end in tears. It did end in terrible destruction as the Assyrians became more and more interested in you know, the nation there and actually came and destroyed the northern part. So Ahaz has chosen a protection of Assyria over God. And Isaiah in chapter 7 and 8 tells him what the result will be. And, you know, a little while ago, one MP said, you know, you should be careful what you wish for in politics. And Ahaz was beginning to feel that, you know, maybe this wasn't the best thing. The Assyrians would come, said Isaiah, but as well as dealing with the northern kingdom of Israel and with Syria, they would also attack Judah herself and sweep down on into Judah, and they ended up encamped around Jerusalem. What should King Ahaz and the people of Judah do at a time like this? Well, Isaiah chapter 9 is a little bit of a sort of future glance by Isaiah to look forward to what God is going to do. And Isaiah tells them that the answer is going to be in better leadership. A leader greater than Ahaz, a leader greater than King Pekah of the northern section of Israel, or indeed King Rezin of Aram, those who are attacking. Isaiah tells in chapter 9 of a leader greater even than the Assyrian emperor. And what Isaiah has to say to them and also to us today is that at a time of weak and sort of compromised leadership, a time when you know, there doesn't seem to be any positive way forward. God's people need to look forward to a leader who will end uncertain government. Let's read that section from chapter 9 again, just so that we get it firmly in our heads. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. Nevertheless, there will be no gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles, by the way of the sea, along the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Well, the first thing that Isaiah picks up in this passage is that God will bring light to a dark situation. God will bring light to a dark situation. You see that in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. He mentions the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, I don't have a sort of a map of the nation to point at, but essentially we're talking about the area in the very north of the land that we would call Israel, okay, around the Sea of Galilee. Isaiah says that there'll be no more gloom for those in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honour Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan, that area around the Sea of Galilee. And what's it talking about? Well, that area up there was the most prone to invasion. So he's probably talking either about the invasion that they'd sort of faced at the hand of the Syrians, or potentially, he's because Isaiah's projecting forward, he may be talking sort of in the past about the Assyrian invasion, but in the future about this gift of the new leader. And what does he have to say is going to happen in this place? Well, he talks about light and darkness. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Now, having just moved to the area, it's very apparent to me there's a big difference in light and dark between living in the city of London and living out here. Okay, the big difference is this. At night time, it gets dark here. In London, it doesn't. It gets brown. Okay, you look up and it's brown. And I think it makes you appreciate a little bit more when you move out to a place where it's darker at night, the sort of threat and the danger that there is in the dark. And I think people of all time have always felt that, you know, when it's dark, it's dangerous. You know, what lies beyond? Is it for the people of Israel and the people of Judah, you know, wild beasts, wild things in the dark? Is it the enemies that move at night, you know, soldiers or robbers or bandits? All of those things come in the dark. And Isaiah says, you know, the people that were up there in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, you know, it's as if it's been a dark, dark place there. And the dark that they've been facing is this shadow of death, as it says. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You know, they've had sort of evil hanging over them up there. You know, potentially, you know, people of Isaiah's day would have thought that the shadow of the death of invading armies hanging over them. But in general, those people, Isaiah says, are facing death, and it looks bad. At the end of chapter 8, Isaiah had said that by turning to the Assyrians, God's people have rejected God's leadership and his law and have plunged themselves into certain judgment. They've turned away from the light of God's words to a judgment so severe and terrible that it will seem like a night, utterly black and dark. The Assyrian emperor, so Isaiah seems to suggest, will lay waste to the nation. Large swathes of the land would eventually be pillaged and ruined by the Assyrians, and especially that area in the north. And the question that you know, people of Judah, but especially the people in the north, would have thought to themselves is, well, what end can there possibly be to a time of darkness like this? Well, the second thing we see in this passage is Isaiah has good news about a leader who wins a decisive victory. A leader who wins a decisive victory. That's verses 3-5. Verse 3 tells us of how God's people will celebrate the light that's coming as they see how God is acting for them once again. See that in verse 3, you have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. There'll be something to celebrate when this light comes into this dark situation. There'll be like people, like farmers who've had a year of great sunshine, plenty of rain, and as they see their crops being harvested, they know there are plenty of good times ahead. We've had oilseed rape planted alongside our house, and just looking at how like high and how sort of yellow it is this year, I the farmer whoever planted it must be so thinking that it's going to be a wonderful crop. And that's exactly what Isaiah says is going to be the feeling that the nation will have as God begins to act in their midst. Verse 4 tells us that it's going to be so good, it'll be like the days when God had worked through Gideon to relieve his people from oppression under the Midianites. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Then the people, when this light comes, where people will be so joyful like farmers, but also then they're not going to be slaves anymore. They're pictured as if they had been oxen tied with leather straps to the yoke of a plow. And they're not going to be like that anymore. They're not going to be slaves. They won't be beaten with rods, as he says at the end of verse 4, the rod of their oppressor, as they probably were by the different people that ruled over them. And then, in fact, verse 5 tells us that everything that the Jewish people have needed to defend themselves will no longer be needed when God begins to act in bringing light. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. So these are the things that the Jewish people had used to rely on to free themselves and keep themselves safe. But Isaiah says, when God begins to act, you're not going to need that stuff anymore. Everything from your battle clothes, from your boots upwards, can all be got rid of. All your robes, your battle armor and things like that are soaked and stained in blood from fighting enemy armies, you just don't need them anymore. You can chuck them on the fire. You can burn them up. Beth's brother is in the army. He has a huge amount of military kit. He's got bags and sort of different sorts of uniforms, different sorts of stuff that he wears. He's got armor that he showed us with metal plates in it. Isaiah says, listen, when God begins to act, you can get rid of all that stuff you're used to relying on. You won't need it anymore. And of course, the big question left at this point in the passage is how? How exactly is God going to bring this light into this dark situation? How will God bring freedom from oppression for his people at the time of Isaiah facing down, the northern kingdom, the Syrians, possible Assyrian invasion in the future? How will God bring light to us today in a difficult situation with political turmoil, with people facing off against each other, creating the sort of difficulties where we know which way they turn in the end? Well, the great thing about this passage is it's very, very clear in telling us. It was because the third thing we see in it is that God will establish his own government through a man who is God. God will establish his own government through a man who is God. In the Bible, it's a big deal who gets credit for God's actions. It's not a light thing at all. God, of course, raised up great men who he used, but it's always very, very important that what God has done is ascribed to God himself and not to the work of men, which is one of the reasons why it's so amazing what Isaiah says in verse 6. He says this: the light, the joy, end of oppression is all going to be down to a child that would be born. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So what Isaiah predicts is a man, a child, a male child. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and this man will lead his people. The government, as he says, will be on his shoulders, just as David Cameron now has the government of our country on his shoulders. So this child that's going to be born in the nation will have the government of God's people on his shoulders. He will be a leader like Moses or Joshua or King David. But unlike Moses or Joshua or King David, this man will have a unique reputation, something that goes well beyond the sort of strict divide between accrediting things to God or accrediting things to man that the nation of Israel had ever seen. This man will be called Wonderful Counselor because he will be one who can perfectly teach and lead his people. In Israel's tradition, of course, the leader was the teacher of the people, pointing them to God's law. He will be known as the Everlasting Father. Like a parent caring for his children, he will lead them lovingly yet firmly. He will be the Prince of Peace, defeating enemies, ending war. In those days, being the Prince of Peace didn't mean sort of being anti-violence as such, but as being one who imposed peace on their area. So the sort of Roman Empire was also another word for it. It was like the Pax Romana, so the peace of the Romans, where they imposed their rule over that. So this ruler will be the Prince of Peace. He will be the one who has imposed his peace over everything. But strangely, and to the Jewish ear, almost inexplicably, this man will also be known as El Gibor, or in English, Mighty God. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, I have to say. I quite look forward to talking to Ben about these words later. But, if I were to tell you no one has ever tried to read this expression as meaning anything other than God, then I'd be lying. Because it's so difficult an expression that it's caused problems pretty much in every generation since Isaiah's own day. Some people try and get out of it, try and read the grammar in different ways and say, well, hold on, maybe it's saying this person is not actually going to be called God himself. Maybe he'll be a mighty one of God or something like that. Okay. But thankfully, and one of the reasons why it always is translated in this way is because there's one wonderful check to this particular sort of phrase, because it's used again in chapter 10. If you look in chapter 10, verse 21, you'll see, and in the original it's the exact same phrase, that it says, a remnant of Jacob will return to the mighty God. Okay, sort of almost impossible to read as anything other than God in that context, which is a great check on the possible range of meanings there in chapter 9, verse 6. So Isaiah says, look, there is darkness, there is trouble, there are problems in your country, just as there are problems about in the world today. God is going to bring joy. He's going to bring a wonderful light shining into your situation. You're not going to need all of that gear that you had to protect yourself before, because God is going to send a new leader into the world, the Son. The government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. In the next verse, we see that this individual's kingdom will never end, because the increase of his government peace will be no end. But why not? Well, of course, because he is Mighty God. You know, his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, not limited, not finite, like it was for King David or King Solomon. You know, that, you know, they had decently long reigns, if you like. But for this leader, there will be no end, because he will be God himself. The influence of his government and his peace will increase. It won't end in eternity. He will reign, fulfilling the promise that had been given to King David, that one of his descendants would reign forever. His reign will be characterized by God's qualities of justice to all and to all, without any shadow of wrongdoing. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Or you can imagine how the people of Isaiah's day would react to this if they had believed it. Fantastic, they would say. God's going to send us a better king, someone amazing who you know, well, strangely sounds like God himself, but in the shape of a man. How can that be? But he will be fantastic. And he'll kick the northern kingdom and the Assyrians, and the Assyrians out will be safe and sound again. But of course, as history tells us, the leader that Isaiah prophesied didn't show up in the days that they were facing those problems. Yes, there'll be a couple of good kings, Hezekiah, Josiah, but no one you could apply these words to. No one that could handle the weight of these labels that Isaiah puts on this child that would be born. The Assyrians never destroyed Judah. But the empire that destroyed Assyria, the Babylonians, they took most of the people away into exile, captivity in Babylon. And the people came back. But still, this leader that Isaiah had said would come had not come. And the people would read this passage in the synagogues, and the sons would ask their fathers, say, well, what was Isaiah talking about? What did he mean? Who was he talking about when he wrote these words? We haven't seen a man like this appear. When will he come to rescue us? When will he come to bring a better government? Until about 700 years after Isaiah wrote these words, another Jewish man was writing about someone he had seen live up to the labels in this passage, someone who really had proved himself to be God living as a man. Matthew chapter 4. Has these words to say. Matthew chapter 4, verse 12. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee. Leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah, land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, the way of the sea, along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. You see, there would be a king sent by God. There would be light amidst the darkness. There would be freedom from oppression. There would be a new government established by God that would end the uncertainty of all the mess of human politics, all of the problems that we face both then and today. There would be someone to lead us perfectly forever. But his kingdom would not be of this world. The enemies he would come to defeat were much bigger and badder than the Assyrians and the Assyrians. They would be as supreme enemies of sin and Satan and death. No, this leader would be enthroned over God's people in eternity, first at the right hand of God, as Jesus is now, and then later when he returns over a restored, renewed world. His name, as Matthew and all the early Christians found out, was Jesus. It was he who was the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed and chosen one, the one that Isaiah wrote about so long before. Now, we have a huge advantage over the people of Isaiah's day in knowing who it was that he was talking about. That's one thing that years have given us, at least. But how can we respond today knowing what Isaiah was talking about so long ago, so 700 years before Jesus himself, knowing those things are true? What kind of response should we have? Well, the first thing we can do is to be glad. Be glad. That's straight out of verse 3. You've enlarged the nation, increased their joy. If we're Christians, the promises of Isaiah 9 are fantastic, because we see what God, Jesus, has done for us. He's the one who's brought light to our dark world. We look around and see a world in a terrible state. Economic problems, political problems, wars, struggles, division. We struggle to make ends meet. And then we see wicked people get rich without even trying. Politicians, despite their efforts, seem incapable of dealing with those big problems of health, of education, of crime. We look around at a closer circle and we see our friends and relatives get sick and tragically get taken from us when they die. And no one seems to be able to do anything about it. Laws get passed. What happens? But Jesus has done something amazing. He's brought light into our world. Our sin has damaged the world. But Jesus has defeated sin. He died that we could be forgiven for the mess that there is in this world, a mess of our own creation. Jesus has rescued us from the oppression of sin and death and Satan. We were slaves, as the nation of Israel were slaves at the time of Midian, as the people at the time that Isaiah was talking about were looking like being at the hands of the Syrians and Assyrians. But Jesus has freed us from a greater oppression, the oppression of sin. So if we're Christians, we read Isaiah's words and we're full of joy. We're full of joy because of what Jesus has done. So that's the first thing we can do. The second way that we can respond to Isaiah's words is to obey. So Isaiah is predicting a leader here who put an end to all uncertain government across the world, one who will reign forever as God's king. Now imagine yourself for a second back in the outer halls, let's say, of the king of Assyria. Okay, now remember, these guys were pretty bad, okay, and you know, had a little bit of a reputation for just killing anyone that annoyed them at all. Okay, if you want sort of a sense of what people are like in those days, the book of Daniel is great for sort of illustrating the no-holds-barred barbarity of the kings of the empires at that time. What do you think that king would say if you went before him and you said, no, I don't fancy doing what you're telling me to do. I don't like what you're saying. I don't think I'll do it today. Or, you know, I can see there's some merit in what you're saying, but I don't think it really applies to me. The king of Assyria, king of Babylon, those sorts of people are the sort of model, if you like, for the intense power and authority that we should recognize in what God has. Okay, what do you think Isaiah would say to us if we said, well, we live in an age where people say, yes, we're Christians, but we're not very keen on intensely putting into action what we read in the Bible that Jesus has said and that he says that we should do? He would think we were mad. Yet every day, you know, we go about and we sort of weigh in the balance the things that God has said to us. Do we take seriously enough what God said, what Jesus said, when he said that we need to love our neighbor? Do we take seriously all of the things that Jesus said about marriage, about caring for others in the church, for the way we treat other people, about not relying on money. These are the things that this incredible king, this powerful, powerful king says to us. Do we do what he says? Or do we weigh him in the balance? So we can be glad about what Jesus accomplished for us. We can be obedient to the things that this amazing king says. And finally, what if we're thinking here tonight, you know what, I'm not sure that I really follow this leader that Isaiah describes. Perhaps I've convinced you tonight that these words spoken so many hundreds of years before Jesus came were speaking of the Lord Jesus. And perhaps you're thinking, well, maybe I can see. This is what the early Christians were beginning to pick up on. That God had promised this person and then he arrived. Perhaps you're thinking, though, you know what, I'm not really glad about Jesus. Perhaps you're thinking, I'm not sure that I'm really into obeying what Jesus has to say. Well, if that's you this evening, I want to recommend to you the solution that every Christian knows, that Isaiah knew as well. Surrender this evening to this leader that God has appointed over us. Bow the knee tonight to this God-man, this king of everything. No, he has acted wonderfully for you by dying in your place. He has, in the words of Isaiah, shattered the yoke that burdens you, the yoke of sin and defeat that lies upon you is destroyed. Start to follow him. Learn his ways. Follow what he said. Then you too can be glad as you live and obey God's wonderful leader, who's put an end to all uncertain government. Let's pray. Our Heavenly